Halle Hansen möchte ich gerne vorstellen und ihm dann das Wort geben. Halle Hansen war von 1995 bis 2001 Generalsekretär der Norske Volkshjelp, der Norwegian Volkshilfe, Norwegian People's Aid, sagen wir NPA in aller Welt, viel einfacher auszudrücken als das umständliche Deutsche oder das Norwegische, was wir nicht so mächtig sind. Die norwegische Volkshilfe, Norwegian People's Aid, ist 1939 gegründet als Antwort der norwegischen Arbeiterbewegung auf den spanischen Bürgerkrieg, hat eine lange Tradition und hat sich zur Aufgabe gesetzt, gegen Ungerechtigkeit, gegen Rassismus, für Stärkung lokaler Macht, für Emanzipation zu kämpfen. Wir haben uns kennengelernt im Rahmen der Landminenkampagne, wo wir, das hat gestern Karl-Heinz Roth auch angesprochen, versucht waren und bemüht waren, darum so etwas wie Schadensbegrenzung zu leisten im Kontext von bestimmten Waffensystemen. Durchaus, was die Situation von Menschen im Süden angeht, erfolgreich, weil das Verbot von Landminen, gerade in Ländern wie Angola zum Beispiel, wo Ralf gearbeitet hat, wirksam geworden ist und dazu beigetragen hat, dass hier ein gewisses Elend weggenommen ist. Aber es ist, wie gesagt, nur eine Form von Schadensbegrenzung. Halle war 13 Jahre lang für das norwegische Fernsehen und den Rundfunk tätig, darunter auch als Korrespondent in Afrika. Er ist inzwischen pensioniert, war dann Vizepräsident von Attac Norwegen, kommt gerade aus dem Sudan zurück, kann also für sich in Anspruch nehmen, ein politischer Aktivist zu sein, zu bleiben. Ich wollte ihn bitten, würde ihn gerne bitten, ein bisschen zu berichten aus der Arbeit von Norwegian People's Aid, aus der auch aus, über die Veränderungen, die die entwicklungspolitischen Konzepte in den zurückliegenden Jahrzehnten genommen haben, auch über die Einflussnahmen des neoliberalen Denkens auf die Entwicklungspolitik, die hat davor ja nicht, die ist ja davor nicht gefeit gewesen, und wir erleben das in allen Zusammenhängen und vor allem, wie man heute unter diesen Voraussetzungen den Zielen von NPA, nämlich lokale Macht zu fördern, entsprechen kann. Wie das geht, wie also Hilfe zwischen Herrschaftssicherung und Emanzipation leistbar ist. Vielleicht am Beispiel des Sudan, und wenn wir viel Glück haben, wird uns Halle dann auch die Frage beantworten, ob denn Norwegen jetzt ganz im Sinne von Ralf Syring ein schon befreites Land ist.
Thanks for the kind words, Thomas, and to all of you comrades and friends, congratulations with the 40 years anniversary, and thank you again for the invitation. And then I would like to associate myself very strongly with the analysis, the very critical analysis and the prescription, the political prescription for the alternative solution that Vandana Shiva gave with regard to food in the world. Thank you. But let me start with the title for the panel and the word or the concept of aid. I do not like it, and it was never there in the beginning of international discussion on these matters. We talked about other words, we talked about international cooperation, development assistance, not aid. So aid, in my view, is a conservative political concept that has conquered our minds and our languages in the aftermath of Reagan and Thatcher. It is paternalistic in its content and meaning. So what has led us to accept the word and this concept? Let me take you on a short historical political journey. It is important to keep in mind that in the first discussion on development in the 1940s and 50s, they took place in a world that was in the midst of the Cold War. The political confrontation between communism and state-run economies on one side and liberal democracy and market economy on the other, with puppet regimes in Africa and elsewhere fighting it out. There were all the time different theories, different political considerations on development and what path to choose that have influenced political discussion and action Some of them are progressive and are progressive, some liberal or conservative, and some are and have always been deeply reactionary. In the first so-called development decade of the United Nations in the 60s, the dominant theory belonged to the American economist Walter Rostow, with his anti-communist manifesto and his thesis on the trickle-down effect. In Norway, we have a saying that is older than Rostow, much older, and it says that when it rains on the priest, it drips on the church warden. So in a more clear-cut political language, it means forces that create inequality. The key message from Rostow and like-minded was and is that the market and the forces of the market is the key to lasting and sustainable development. But things changed. As we entered and passed through the 1960s, big political changes took place in the world. First and foremost, the liberation of the colonies, and at the end of the 1960s, the composition of the United Nations was fundamentally altered. Decolonization and liberation had created a new political majority, and out of that new political majority, a new political reality came with new ideas and new theories for development. And in the United Nations and in other fora, in the 1970s, the emphasis was no longer on the trickle-down effect and similar, but on human basic needs and, in political and developmental terms, how to satisfy those. In the General Assembly in the mid-1970s, a resolution was passed called A New World Economic Order, with an ideological flavor towards the left. And for a few years, it contributed to a lively and very important international discussion on how to establish the political process and how to use the means and the tools that created lasting growth, development, and progress, and equality. The ideas contained in the proposal were in the most progressive and, in my view, sometimes revolutionary. It attracted the interest of the countries of the South and progressive forces in the North. And in addition, we had an emerging and enlightened debate on environment linked to development. So for a few years, some of us believed that we would have a new and progressive world order. We got one, but not the one we envisaged. Six years after the vote in the United Nations, and now in the year of 1980, the people of the United States elected Ronald Reagan as their president, and shortly after, the conservatives in Britain, Margaret Thatcher, as their prime minister. This led to a paradigm shift in world politics. In the USA, we had since the early 1970s had the teaching of Milton Friedman and his Chicago Boys, and their testing out of theories in Chile during the Pinochet dictatorship. But their thinking had conquered not only the Republicans in the United States and the conservatives in Britain, it conquered many other political parties, many other political minds in all corners of the world, not least in Europe. The political ideology that grew out of all of this was neoliberalism and its implementing philosophy, globalization and free market and raw capitalism. The essence in the new political message was the less state, the better, the less public welfare, the better, the more privatization, the better, and there was no place for the common good or for the commons or of a natural commons. The free market and its forces were not only the way to heaven, meaning prosperity for all, but the only way to heaven. It was the end of history, they said. It was the time of the believers. They saw the United Nations as a talking club of Marxists, Leninists, communists, socialists, and similar, that ideally should be abolished, but in the short run, at least bypassed and undermined to the extent possible. We got Group 7, the Club of the Very Rich. Development cooperation and money for the same was waste of money, waste of manpower and waste of time. To the extent anything of development assistance, now called aid, was needed, it was emergency aid for the very needed when natural calamities struck. Keep in mind that from 1980 to 1993-94, in the course of 12-15 years, the OECD average of gross national product for development cooperation fell from little 0.4 of GNP to almost nothing, 0.2. And we were back at square one, which was the year of 1960, when OECD started measuring and making statistics for this. But our governments talk of too much development aid. According to the neoliberals, development should and could only be carried out by the market forces, by the multinational corporations, and the direct financial investments. That was the foundation for the kind of monster capitalism we have seen in the world since. The World Bank and the IMF became, from 1980 and onwards, the instrument for those with the voting power, the United States and the rest of us. We got the structural adjustment programs, the SAP, that was imposed on all weak developing countries as a precondition for any assistance or aid at all. Now we know that SAP was a political, big political fiasco, but it weakened African states to the point in which they could hardly function. It made it impossible for a long period for millions of poor families to let their children go to school because they did not have the World Bank required school fee. And the same was the case with health services. The witch doctor became the only affordable alternative for very poor in African and other developing societies. The influence of neoliberal thinking on development was perhaps somewhat weakened during the 1990s, but it never died. It is still there. It only had added something new, the technocratization and the bureaucratization of the language of the international debate on development. We got the Paris Club. Do you know what it is? We got the phrases of national ownership, donor coordination and harmonization of aid. We got the new concept of policy coherence. We still have this bureaucratic discussion on what we now call aid. It has not led to more progress and better everyday life for the poor, but it has definitely had one very negative political impact. It has taken the debate on the issues away from the people, from political debate at large. It has created, in my view, what you in German call politische Entfremdung. On top of all this, we had the 11th of September 2001 with the terrorist attack on targets in the United States and a political fallout of the tragic event that was hard to foresee, but which, led by the Bush policies, has created a more dangerous world for all of us than ever before. So with all this in mind, what are we now on the 31st of May 2008? I would say in the period of insecurity and confusion, the ideas and policies related to neoliberalism are now definitely on the defense, and they are being decisively weakened and challenged by many other different factors and trends. The United States under President Bush has conducted both economic and foreign policies that for long have been a disaster for which we all shall have to pay for generations to come. The invasion of Iraq was based on the big lie, now confirmed by his former press secretary Scott McClellan, that the horrible Saddam Hussein regime had nuclear arms. The Iraq war itself is a catastrophe with worldwide negative political implications that will be long-lasting. The international intervention and the war in Afghanistan that followed 9/11 might end up the same way. The combination of another set of catastrophic US policies on Israel and Palestine and the European helplessness and servility towards the United States have left the world with a much more difficult and more dangerous Middle East situation than ever before in recent history. At the same time, political and economic power is moving from the north to the south. And this is a trend which I welcome. We, the rich whites in Europe and North America, are after all a small minority of 15% of the world population, and we are a shrinking minority. So it's time that we have a more equal sharing of power and resources in the world. The countries of the South are now equaling the OECD countries when it comes to their share of world trade. And the same goes for the consumption of oil and energy. And they hold 70% of the world foreign currency reserve. China is more and more, for African countries, their most important economic partner. India is getting more important for Africa, and the same goes for other Asian countries like Malaysia and South Korea. In a few years, Asia will be much more important as a partner for Africa than Europe and the United States. Brazil, under President Lula, in my view, is leading a social and political change process in Latin America that slowly improves the lives, not in all places, but in many places, of tens and tens of millions of poor families. And Brazil is rapidly becoming an important political and economic actor globally, not least in Africa. On top of all this, we have global environmental changes, first and foremost the climate change, that will more and more affect us all and demand from us in the North a fundamental change of consumption patterns and lifestyle. At the same time, these changes will in particular hit the have-nots of the world hardest, with Africa hardest hit. And on the very top of all that, the world food crisis. With inflation following, with unemployment following, and with increasing desperations in the slums, in the big cities of the South. We have seen it all over Africa recently, not only in South Africa and in Kenya. We will see more of it in the rest of this year, and in the years to come. So there is a multipolar world emerging, and I do not know what kind of world is in the waiting. I hope it is a better world. It is definitely a different world. And my uncertainty is linked with regard to the future powers and their respect for human rights, human dignity, as well as their political will to carry out policies of solidarity and policies for the protection of the earth. I have no secure recipes for all this, but I know that there is one absolutely necessary instrument, and that is civil society well organized. Time is running out for me. My script will be made available in its full. But I should say something about the Norwegian people's aid. Thomas was making a reference to the beginning, and we have been like that all the time since. The key point in our mission statement is that we shall take a stand, and a political stand in favor of the oppressed and the poor whenever we are challenged and whenever we can move on the issues. So we have been a key actor on the Norwegian side in the liberation struggle in Southern Africa, in particular with ANC in South Africa. We have been in many Latin American countries, in Chile during the dictatorship, with the Sandinista in Nicaragua, and we did the same in Guatemala and El Salvador. And we did it in Sudan with the peoples of South Sudan. We took a stand in support of them in 1987 in support of a armed struggle. I came from Sudan 2 weeks ago. I was the guest at the first SPLM convention since the comprehensive ceasefire. The first in 14 years, there were 2,500 people in the hall when they opened. And I can tell you that it was a fantastic experience to be part of that, because those who were in the hall, for most of them, they have never experienced anything like that before. There were many women who came from villages. Many women who probably couldn't read and write, because in many villages in South Sudan, no women can read and write. But they came in the most beautiful dress. They became because they had a lot of hard life experience, because they were wise people. And then they came from the diaspora, dressed in the most beautiful dress combined with tradition. And others again, dressed businesslike. The tall Dinka men came, and the big northern people, the Arab people came, and they met for the first time ever under one slogan: no to war, yes to peace, freedom and development. We don't know what will happen in Sudan, but I know for sure that I, 2 weeks ago, was part of something that was unique in the history of the peoples I shared those days with. It was their first meeting to discuss the future patterns for daily development. Let me stop there, but just say that if I was to sum up some recommendations for the future, what are the most important political solidarity challenges for the future and for us? I see three areas of fundamental importance. We must preserve, to the extent possible, our independence as civil society, so that we have the political freedom to act the way we want to. We must prove in practice solidarity with the oppressed, the poor and the voiceless, wherever they are in the world, and we must always defend human dignity, human rights and real democracy. We must stand in solidarity with Mother Earth. The successful fight for our living planet, the Earth, is now of decisive importance to our children, grandchildren, to mankind and our common future. We are the only force, when we also mobilize mass movement and develop global networks, that can defeat monster capitalism. Thank you very much.